Let's get back to more Mark Crotty on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Hey, let's talk about the Bears and the National Football League. We haven't done enough of that tonight. Sometimes we pre-record things to make things fit into other people's schedules. So that's what we did earlier today. I got a chance to talk to Mike Golic Jr., who you know from many things. He's a college football analyst for Learfield. So he knows college football. He knows prospects around the league. So I thought this would be a pretty perfect time to talk with him. So here is my conversation with Mike Golic Jr.
Well, first things first, I mean, I have to ask you about what the Bears did in the first round, Caleb Williams and Roma Dunze. Is that close to what you thought they would do? And are you thumbs up on it like so many people seem to be?
Yeah, I don't know if the Bears could have hit a bigger home run with this, right? It seems tailor made for them to do so just based on their draft order. So much of the groundwork for this laid last year in the trade that ultimately netted the Carolina Panthers Bryce Young and the Chicago Bears a haul that they have turned into a really strong foundation for their future. Caleb Williams, certainly wire to wire during the pre-draft process, the consensus number one pick, which should tell you something considering how much of the pre-draft process was spent with people overanalyzing what color his fingernails or his cell phone was, trying to have conversations about his dad or what he wanted out of NFL ownership stake. Not once did it budge him from the top stop. That's the undeniable tools that this player possesses and what we've seen from him at the college level. And then Roma Dunze, to go into a wide receiver room now that all of a sudden has the cupboards completely restocked, no longer just DJ Moore and the tight end room there, but now you add Keenan Allen to the mix. And Roma Dunze, big-bodied receiver, that true X you saw at Washington this last year, did so much damage outside the numbers on contested catches. He's like a basketball player, the way that he can contort his body, shield the football, and make big-time catches. So incredibly quarterback-friendly targets to go along with a team that over the last couple of seasons has really reset its foundation overall.
Where did you have Roma Dunze ranked just relative to Marvin Harrison Jr., who goes to Arizona at number 4, and then Malik Nabers as well, who ends up going to the Giants at 6?
I had him just below Marvin Harrison Jr., but above Malik Nabers. I think Marvin Harrison Jr., I think people just got bored after a while because we had for so long talked about him as the top receiver prospect. Just so unbelievably smooth, had to make a lot out of a little this past season with the quarterback situation at Ohio State, and did so really, really well. And I think his game is just so ready-made for the NFL, but I don't think Rome's super far behind that when you look at what he affords you from a size perspective. Such a smooth route runner and smooth player in general that probably doesn't get enough credit for the speed that he displays as well. And so I think a lot of those same things that you like about him, and I think both of them just a little more polish on their game right now than Malik Nabers, who's incredibly explosive, jumps off the page, no doubt, especially working in the slot. But I think with that top pick, I love a guy that can operate on the outside, really bend the defense and change the shape of coverage in a way that helps the rest of the team as well.
Couple more things on the Bears before I ask a couple questions about the rest of the NFL and what's going on in the Bears division. But the Bears did draft this year a punter, and that's definitely been a hot topic around here, that the Bears take the Iowa punter, Torrey Taylor, who I'm sure you saw a lot of. Was this a worthwhile pick for the Bears to take Torrey Taylor as high as they did?
As high as they did, you can always sort of debate. I kind of treat it like, you know, special teamers and fantasy football, or, you know, picking defenses and quarterbacks later on. But I, as a college football fan, I am thrilled that Torrey Taylor has found a great home and was valued. He was one of the only enjoyable things to watch about Iowa football this season outside of the defense. And so there's certainly value in that player there. I do think, and the Caleb Williams text on draft night was funny, hey, you're not going to be punting a lot. It is kind of like sending Michael Penix Jr. to go sit behind Kirk Cousins, where it's like, well, I'd actually like to see this guy get to play a little more, maybe send him to a worse offense. And I think the Bears have a pretty good chance to make another solid jump on that side of the ball. So, yeah, maybe we won't see him as often. It's probably a little bit overvalued, but I still like the player a lot, and adding a fun player like that to a team like this, to me, I'm never going to complain too much about.
Well, since you mentioned Penix, I'm gonna derail a little bit here. I don't think I had as big of a problem with Atlanta taking Michael Penix Jr. Not only did it allow the Bears to take Rome Odunze, but I don't know. You have Kirk Cousins there, who, you know, obviously is a little banged up right now. How much longer is he gonna? I mean, I know he's got a lot of life left in him, but I just feel like it's always good to load up how important the backup quarterback is these days. What did you think of the Michael Penix draft pick at number 8 to the Atlanta Falcons?
Like, there's ways that you can look at it in a vacuum that makes sense like that, right? Like, yes, there is absolutely merit to if you believe you are getting value on a player. And Michael Penix Jr. went under talked about during the draft cycle because for him the big concern was injury and age, right? He's older and he's been super banged up during his college career, albeit not in the last couple of years at UW. But then you look outside of that and go, all right, well, the Atlanta Falcons, when they gave Kirk Cousins $100 million over the next two seasons, instantly in a lot of people's minds and evaluation vaulted to a team that can win the NFC South. That puts you in win-now mode. When you bring in a quarterback like that, pay him that kind of money at this stage in his career, when you're a new staff, it looked like, all right, we're starting the clock now. And then you look around the rest of this Atlanta Falcons roster and go, well, you know, the defense made a lot of improvement last year, but it's going to be a new system this year with Raheem Morris, and it's also going to be a defense that still needs help in specific areas. Now, they addressed some of that later on in the draft along the defensive line, but to me, it just seemed like a use of resources in a way that doesn't align with the timeline you've presented so far this offseason. If you were a team that was really loading up for tomorrow, that's great, but right now it just seems like they're trying to have their cake and eat it too in a way that's really difficult to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely going to take some patience on their part, and it does suck when a guy is drafted in the first round, and theoretically, the best thing would be for him not to play. So I do understand the complications. I just don't hate it as much as everybody else. One of the guys that I could not figure out, Mike, I was at the combine, I've covered all these NFL events, and JJ McCarthy to me was one of the most difficult guys to slot and to figure out. In my second mock draft, I had him going to the Patriots at number 3, then the Patriots ended up taking Drake May in that spot, but there was so much good talk about him at the combine, and then thereafter, I know a lot of GMs that really like JJ McCarthy. He ends up in the Bears division with Minnesota at 10. What do you think about JJ McCarthy, the prospect, and did Minnesota get gold at number 10 overall without having to trade up?
I don't know if they got gold. They definitely, through the pre-draft process, convinced us. Like, whoever was in charge of the JJ McCarthy PR campaign did a great job of convincing us, hey, he could really go top 5. And now all of a sudden when they get him at 10, it seems like a value pick to us. Where
I fell for it, Mike. I fell for all that chatter, man, and you are exactly right.
Well, it's because it's one of those things that when we were grading the prospect, when we ended college football season, where JJ McCarthy was the quarterback of the 15-0 national championship team, most of us were still like, maybe back half of the first round, maybe even a second round guy based on production that we never saw match the gifts that people saw and talked about with JJ McCarthy, who has a strong arm, who could do a bunch of fun off platform stuff, who's got some bleep you throws in his bag. But anytime push came to shove or a critical situation came up, it always seemed like Michigan went to someone else or another facet of their game. And so I have a lot of questions. I think what JJ McCarthy in Minnesota is going to represent and show us is the value of your surroundings at quarterback. We talk a lot more about that now than we have before, where normally in the first round as a quarterback, you got to bootstrap the hell out of this thing. You're supposed to fix this entire franchise by yourself, on the block, no help. JJ McCarthy walks into a great situation right now and a great play caller right now who are all going to work hard to take care of him. And so I think it's going to be a good reminder. He probably has a strong chance to be successful. It's a similar equation to what he dealt with in Michigan. And so I won't be shocked when he does well. I just don't know how well he's capable of yet because we haven't seen him have to come even close to touching his ceiling.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, like I said, I had him going 3 to the Pats. I didn't agree with my own mock. It's just from all the whispers. And everything. That's what I told everybody. I said, sure. This is where I got it. I don't like my own mock, but we've been hearing things, man, about J.J. McCarthy. So, I mean, apparently in the end, the GM settled down a little bit. Jaden Daniels goes to Washington at 2. Drake May to the Patriots at number 3. The other position, I mean, Minnesota scored in this thing, if you look at it like that, that they get J.J. McCarthy, and then they get Dallas Turner. Now, of these defensive ends, I was very uncomfortable, and it played out this way, looking at any of those edge rushers, defensive ends in the top 10, and that's the way it worked out. I guess I was a little bit surprised that the top defensive end ended up being Laiatu Latu with the Colts, and for people who don't know, yeah, he goes to the Colts at 15. Like I said, Dallas Turner to Minnesota at 17, Jared Verse to the Rams at 19, and the Dolphins get Chop Robinson at number 21. What did you think about that crew, and what did you think about Laiatu being the first guy to come off the board?
Yeah, actually, he would have been my first pick to come off the board early. I think there's things that you could nitpick absolutely about all these guys that you mentioned in that edge class, but when I looked at Laiatu Latu, at the very least, I went, all right, coming in early as a rookie, what can we hang our hat on? What do I know right away? And what I know right away is this guy's an NFL-level pass rusher already, like a complete arsenal of moves, counters, all that stuff. He's a polished player, and once I think you got past the medical concerns, it made it a lot easier stomach, kind of similar to Michael Penix Jr., career trajectory-wise in that way. So I was comfortable with him there. Dallas Turner, unique set of physical gifts. Like, I remember watching him opposite Will Anderson Jr., who ended up being, you know, Houston's second top draft pick last year, and your eyes would just kind of drift over there because his game's got more sex appeal to it. He can do things movement skill-wise that very few people on earth can do. So there's a lot to like about that. I do wonder for Minnesota, who I said kind of did the store brand version of what Houston did last year. Hey, draft a quarterback first with your top pick and then trade up a little bit in the first round to go and get your pass rusher of the future on the opposite side of the ball. I just don't think Dallas Turner is ready to come in and have as immediate an impact as Will Anderson Jr. did last year, who is just a prospect much further along in his football life cycle. Ruthlessly efficient is how I describe Will Anderson Jr. And for Dallas Turner, I think it's a lot more about the tools and the promise of what could come in Brian Flores' defense than necessarily what might show up on day one.
I like that. Ruthlessly efficient. Is that possible? You could be ruthless and efficient? Because efficient connotes calm to me, Mike Golic Jr.
You know what? I would say, and this is one that'll ring true in the division here, that was always how I felt about watching Elgton Jenkins when he was coming out of Mississippi State before he got to the Green Bay Packers. He was a guy who you almost like, you got bored watching on tape because he was the peak of efficiency, but he'd get his hands on guys and he would absolutely maul them, but he was never out of sorts, never out of whack. And the same thing kind of happened with Will Anderson Jr. Again, wasn't as sexy as watching Dallas Turner on the other side, who's giving guys ghost moves and Euro steps and dipping under arms. And then there's just Will Anderson Jr. showing up in the backfield, stunning offensive linemen who are trying to pull and kick him out, making plays on running backs, making tight ends' lives a living hell. And so ruthlessly efficient were the words that I kept coming back to, whether they fit or not.
I might at some point in time, I might steal that from you, but I am going to forever give you credit for it. Is that cool with you? Do I have permission right now, Mike?
Oh, you don't even have to give me credit for it, man. This is sports media. Steal away. We're all just stealing from somebody else. I'm sure in my peanut brain, I adopted this from somebody way smarter than me.
That's hilarious. I was having a conversation about like words that we use in our everyday vernacular, like say like the word sick, like, oh, that player is sick or whatever. People like, oh, where'd you get that? Well, I probably got it from somebody else. Nobody actually makes anything up in this world anymore. We all get stuff from everybody else.
The Simpsons did everything already. We're just playing for second.
That is the truth. We're talking to Mike Golic Jr. I am Mark Grody here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. A couple more Bears I want to ask about to you before I get you out of here. In the third round, the Bears take a tackle. At least I think he's going to be a tackle. Karan Amagaji out of Yale, third round pick, 6'5", 323. It looks like, at least from what Ryan Poles has been transparent about, that ideally he would be a swing tackle for the Bears to start. But what does your scouting eye tell you about Kareem Amagaji?
Yeah, I think really technically sound player and one that's walking into an organization that, listen, when you've got the O-line GM, there are certain organizations that are going to get a little more credit for the ability to kind of develop and place guys in the right spot at this position. We've seen around the NFL, O-line is a really hard position for a lot of people to scout. And when I look at where guys are going to be successful, I usually look at, hey, is this a coach or an organization that's got a good track record? Like the Tennessee Titans just hired Bill Callahan, who came over with his son, Brian Callahan. You look at the job he had done with the Cleveland Browns. You look at the job he did early. He was Zach Martin's first offensive line coach in Dallas, like proven commodity in developing young players. And so you see them pick J.C. Latham that might not totally fit in a lot of people's minds, but I trust the coach. The Dallas Cowboys select Tyler Guyton, the guy who's really raw but toolsy out of Oklahoma, that in most organizations that would have worried about taking that high. But Dallas gets the benefit of the doubt, and I think we're starting to get to that point with Ryan Poles as well, where he's got the eye for this because he also lived this in a way that just gives you such a leg up when you're looking and going and trying to develop this position.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, he's hit on his left tackle and his right tackle so far. He moved Tevin Jenkins inside. So, yeah, we all kind of assume that Ryan Poles would be good at this, and it's sort of playing out that way. While I'm on offensive line, just sort of at large here, the Chargers take Joe Alt. He was the first offensive lineman to come off the board. Do you think he was the best offensive lineman in college football last year?
I do. In my mind, Joe, who, you know, listen, during his Notre Dame career, I got to watch every snap this guy played and watch the development. And I think Joe is the top guy for two reasons. Is one, he comes in with that insanely high floor that I think if you're going to draft an offensive lineman in the first round, especially this high, you need a guy that comes from a pedigree program who's gotten great coaching, who's going to be able to go out and do a lot of that stuff early because you just don't have enough time in training camp now in the offseason program to give guys the reps to develop at most outlets to make things happen. So he's got that going away, extremely mature in terms of his approach to the game, the way he goes about dissecting pass rushers, what they're going to do, mixing up his sets, using his arm length. A lot of people talk about arm length guys, but I always want to see, hey, does it show on tape? There's plenty of long arm guys out there that don't play like it. You look at every pass pro rep that Joe Alt is a part of, and you see him keeping defenders well out of their comfort zone with his arm length, despite the power of the strike or any of the concerns people had. But the other thing is, Joe's still 21 going on 22 with an insane amount of upside. He's a guy that hasn't played the position for a super long time, and so you get all of this athletic ability. You know, I think in terms of miles per hour they measured at the combine, was like the second fastest 40 time amongst the offensive linemen this year, and you look at just what a mountain of a man he is. There's a lot for them to work with him going into a system with Jim Harbaugh and Greg Roman where they're going to prioritize all that stuff up front. So I think there's plenty of upside, but an already incredibly high floor for the guy that absolutely was my top tackle.
Yeah, and that's definitely one of the ones that I got right in my mock draft. I was like, of course, to your point, I mean, is there anybody better or more perfect for Joe Alt? I know some people might have thought wide receiver, but that is classic Jim Harbaugh right there. It's going to be really interesting to see what he does with that team if he's able to turn around what is still a pretty talented roster. Mike, this has been great. I love your insight and your energy. I'm just going to say it. This has been ruthlessly efficient, my friend. Thank you so much.
The highest of compliments. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
Mike Golic Jr. right there. Great conversation with him earlier today. I'm Mark Grody. When we return, let's get back into the Chicago Cubs. We began the show talking about the Cubs. We had Andy Martinez on earlier. But let's try to fix some of the issues that the Cubs are dealing with, most as the result of injuries. But let's get some solutions, and maybe they will come from the Iowa Cubs. That's next on The Score.
And the next pitch, a little looping line drive into center field, a base hit, and another run is going to score. A soft single up the middle by Jake Bowers. Soft singles and stolen bases. That has led to a three-run rally here in this eighth inning, and Milwaukee has taken a 3-1 lead.
Let's get back to more Mark Grody on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Nobody expected Edbert Alzolay to have this type of start to his season. Four blown saves, blew another one today, came in, gave up three runs in the eighth inning today, and the Cubs ultimately lose to the Brewers by a final score of 3-1. It has just been absolutely rough and in some ways inexplicable what's going on with Edward Alzolay. But that was costly today as the Cubs go down. That was the Jake Bowers RBI hit. And as I mentioned earlier when we're talking to Andy Martinez, man, he had favorable counts, Alzolay, for every batter that he faced, even starting with the first guy that he faced when he came in Jackson Churio, that ended up in a full count with him before he singled to start it. And then William Contreras was 1-2 before Alzolay gives up the RBI hit to tie the game. And then both Willie Adames and Jake Bowers had 1-2 counts. So that to me is startling and scary that he doesn't have a put-away pitch right now. And you just can't. Like, I was good with him going out there today again, despite the four blown saves. Like, this guy can't have just lost it. But at this point, you cannot put him in his next playing for Craig Counsell cannot be in a high leverage position. And I don't know if that means low leverage or if that means phantom injury or whatever he wants to do. Somebody suggested earlier that maybe have him be an opener, have him pitch, tell him he's pitching one inning in a game and that's it. Sit down and rebuild this guy's confidence and whatever physically is going wrong with him as well. But in the name of solutions, and that's what we've been trying to talk about. We know that Hector Neris is capable of closing games. He just makes me a little bit nervous. Could it down the road, based on what we saw out of Hayden Wesneski today, could he be somebody that is in high leverage? Is it Ben Brown, who has been fine as a starter, but is his best yet to come? Two-pitch pitcher like Ben Brown, could he get a shot at closing or high leverage? But one guy that I've been paying attention to when I can is Carl Edwards, CJ Edwards, of the World Series Cubs. Carl came up with the Cubs, and he almost made the big league roster to begin this season. He was one of the last cuts, but he's been playing in Iowa. And last night, we had on Alex Cohen, who is the lead broadcaster for the Iowa Cubs, and I asked him, so, hey, how's Carl doing down there?
He has been awesome. Yeah, Carl obviously was in spring training with the Cubs, was on the cusp of making the team out of spring training. Then he requested his own release, signed back with the Cubs 3 weeks later. He started off with the Iowa Cubs, I think it was two series ago in St. Paul. He had a rough first outing. He walked three, but since he's got a sub-2 ERA. Still trying to get his fastball velocity back to what it was during spring. His last outing, though, 92, 93 miles per hour. He had that great knuckle curve, struck out a batter a couple nights ago on that. It was just absolutely filthy. And again, with Carl, I think that he will be back up in the big league sooner rather than later for the Cubs, just with the way that he's pitching and the way that the organization knows him, knows what he can contribute. You know, for a team that right now, Chicago Cubs, they're competing. They're 6 games over .500. They're one of the best teams in the National League. And you can get a guy like Carl Edwards Jr., who's won a World Series with the team, you know, get him up to the bullpen latter half of the year. He can really help the team.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. I think that he's going to come up. I'm not saying that he's going to be your closer or even your eighth inning guy, but I think that they got to give it a try. I mean, you've got him. He has been good in the minors. We know that he's capable of pitching in the majors. We've all seen it out of him. And he would also be... He and Kyle Hendricks would be the only lasting players from the 2016 World Series team. So I was like putting that together. And I was thinking about it. Like, one of the things that I thought about the 2016 Cubs and the subsequent breakup of it when they were all traded at the deadline by Jed Hoyer, like that parade of players, Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo and Kyle Schwarber and Javier Baez. I said, you know, I could see, like, maybe one or two of those guys making their way back to the Cubs down the road, not necessarily as like a core piece at this point, but just being on the team. Now I look at it and it's like, are any of these guys good enough? Like, it is jarring when you think about what has happened to some of these guys and that Jed Hoyer did the right thing with them. Like, Javier Baez has just been a mess. Anthony Rizzo has been the best of the bunch, probably. We know the problems that Chris Bryant, man, Chris Bryant is like baseball.
That's the most shocking one.
Baseball irrelevance.
Yes.
That's what he's fallen into. Like, people are not paying attention to Chris Bryant. I mean, it's amazing.
And he's not even close to where he was as a player.
Not even close. Kyle Schwarber actually has been pretty good. Like, that would be really cool, Schwarber. Like, if he's a guy that's hitting 35, 40 home runs a year, like, and I could see him doing that for a long time, and, you know, maybe a one-year deal with Schwarber down the road, like that.
At the time, I feel like when people were discussing which one of these guys would you part with in a trade, people would have said Schwarber. Like, oh, he can't field.
Yes.
Like, let's trade Schwarber. And now, if you ask which one of those guys would you bring back if you could, the answer would definitely be Schwarber.
Yeah, because he can hit home runs with the best of them. That's what everybody thought about Kyle Schwarber. I don't necessarily have like, oh man, the Cubs should have kept Kyle Schwarber. I don't feel that way because at the time I felt like it was time to move on from Kyle Schwarber. But at this point, I think that he'd be the only one, quote unquote, eligible to return to the Cubs if we want to go into that that motif right there for the Chicago Cubs. I'm going to get to some of your calls here in a second. 312-644-6767 if you want to talk about the Cubs. But there's one other name that is on the come in the Cubs minor league system, and he's their number two prospect. He is a starting pitcher who was just promoted to AAA Iowa. I think he pitches tomorrow for AAA Iowa. He is Cade Horton, and Alex Cohen was talking about him as well.
He's really athletic. You look at him, 6'1", 210 pounds, and every motion about him is just athletic. It's a whippy arm action. Ball just jumps out of his hand. Just watching his highlights, watching his bullpen, everything is sharp, everything is hard, everything is fluid. And it's really interesting because if you look at some of the top prospects in all of baseball from a pitching perspective, you have Cade Horton, who's arguably the third best prospect in all of minor league baseball when it comes to starting pitching. Paul Skeens is number one. And you couldn't have two more different pitchers because Paul Skeens, tall, big, thick, everything is heavy. Sinker ball pitcher, throws four different pitches, really gets it on the hands. And Cade Horton, a little bit shorter, more athletic, whippy motion. It just couldn't be more different. And these guys both have had so much success in their minor league career to this point. Obviously, Skeens was taken a year after Cade Horton when it comes to minor league baseball experience. But, you know, those are two pitchers right now in the National League Central. It is not if they're going to get to the big leagues. It is when and when this year. So they're both really impressive. I'm really looking forward to seeing Cade Horton make his AAA debut this weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. I always love it. I love it when there is a prospect and he's on the cusp in this day and age. Like, we're all watching. We're all keeping track. We're all listening and watching you, Alex, because we're all excited about it. And Cade Horton, he did pass the first test, four games with Double-A Tennessee, 1-0 with a 1.10 ERA and 18 strikeouts. You've seen a lot of these prospects through the years, whether doing what you do or just watching the Chicago Cubs. Is Cade Horton the type of guy who can ascend to – is he like the type of guy that's projected to ascend eventually to the top of a rotation? How good is Cade Horton relative to maybe other big-time Cubs pitching prospects and the pitchers that exist now?
Well, first and foremost, he's probably the most highly anticipated Cubs starting pitching prospect since Mark Pryor.
Wow.
And that is not hyperbole.
Okay.
You know, seventh overall pick obviously came to the Cubs with an arm injury, limiting his innings his first year. But now, I mean, it's all steam ahead. You know, he went five innings in his last start with Tennessee, struck out six, didn't give up a run. And then coming up to Iowa as a 22-year-old righty, I mean, it's just plus stuff, three pitches, fastball, you know, mid to high 90s. And again, not a big guy, but it's just such an athletic delivery. There's so much movement of all his pitches and his poise. I mean, if you look at his stats in his minor league career, albeit brief, doesn't walk many hitters. He's in and around the strike zone. If anything, he's effectively wild with the secondaries, gets a lot of swings and misses on those. It is the most anticipated Cubs pitching prospect in two decades, and I think he's going to live up to that.
Get Cade Horton up here, stat. if he is the best Cubs pitching prospect since Mark Pryor. That doesn't mean he's as good or better than Mark Pryor, but that's singing some pretty high praise considering how touted Mark Pryor was. And Mark Pryor, pound for pound, probably my, like, for a season, the 2003 season, the 18-6 season with a 2-something ERA, might have been my favorite Cubs pitching season ever from a fan standpoint. Obviously, what Jake Arrieta did was phenomenal. Greg Maddux had won a Cy Young with the Cubs. John Lester and what he did. I mean, there's been some, you know, Kerry Wood, if you want to throw him in there as well. But God, what Pryor did that year, 2003, was just absolutely dominant. I love hearing about Cade Horton. And look, like I said, Justin Steele is coming back soon. Jordan Wick's still on the shelf. Shota Imanaga has been just unbelievable with what he has been able to do. The 1-0 game on Wednesday at the Mets, 7 shutout innings. That was the famous double play game that ended the game. Hap to Madrigal to Amaya. That was Shota's game. He's just been fantastic. Kyle Hendricks maybe coming back soon. He's still got to go to Iowa to see if he can be as good as he was at Double A. But it's good to hear about Cade Horton. Let me take a couple of your calls here really quickly. 312-644-6767. We start with Dave in Slinger. What's up, Dave? How you doing, man?
How are you doing? And thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Dave.
I'm sorry about today's loss. But I thought when we had the 1-0 league, I thought sure that game was going to be ours. But it evidently didn't turn out that way. But I hope we can win these next two games and get back to the top. And how do you see the season for the Cubs this year?
Dave, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. I think the Cubs have a really good season, actually. And a lot of it is based on the success that they are having right now. Hey, man, this is enough right here. Justin Steele and Jameson Taillon began, your two top starting pitchers began the season on the injured list. Kyle Hendricks, I don't know if he's ever going to ascend back to being what he once was. You barely have had Kyle Hendricks pitching for you this year. You are without your two best offensive players, I would say, probably. And Cody Bellinger and Seiya Suzuki was scalding every baseball that came his way. They've managed to manipulate a 19-14 record at this point.
One of your best old bullpen arms and Julian Merriweather gets hurt right away. Your other best bullpen arm gives up more home runs in the first month of the season than he gave up all of last year. Everything's going wrong.
Right.
And they're 19-14.
Right. That's it. That's it. I mean, that's why I started the show today. It was like, the Cubs are 19-14. It felt like after today they were 14-19, just because when you have bullpen games that break down, it's painful. Like I said, once they get closer to full strength, and you always have to curve it for potential injuries. But can you imagine this team with in the warmth of July and having their arms back, and Craig Counsell by that time in theory having figured out more about the Cubs? There's a pretty good chance that they're going to be really good, Dave. Thanks for the call, man. Let's go to Bill in Roscoe Village. What up, Bill?
Hey, Mark.
Billy.
Hey, listen, I agree with you. It feels like a 14-19 team to me, too, because they've lost so many games that it felt like they should have won.
Yes.
And I'm sitting there today, and he goes to get Love Lady Counsell, and I look to the bullpen, and I couldn't believe he was bringing Aldley in that situation. It's basically a save situation, up 1-0. They're not scoring any runs. If he blows it here, the game's over. And I couldn't help think, like, he's too smart for this, right? This was like a Ross move. And this might sound crazy, but was he bringing him in, like, holding the final nail in his coffin, right? To say, hey, he blows it here, this clears the runway. I don't have to just protect him and bury him and bring him in low-leverage situations that don't mean anything. We need guys that can actually get out. This will be the end-all, be-all on Alzolay.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's a potential theory. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I think, though, it is more because Craig, like I was talking about this earlier, Craig Counsell is pushing the limits with everybody. to figure them out. His starting pitchers, he's pushing the limits as far as he can. And at times, like Javier Assad, he has pushed the limits a little bit too far. I think with Alzolay, you're right. I mean, you're not going to see him in high leverage anytime soon. There has to be some sort of you know, quote-unquote rehab to get him right before you're going to do that again. Also, I think that there's two other parts that play in here. You had to put somebody out there in Alzolay, and I get it. In hindsight, there's a million other guys that could have gone in there. There's the part about that. And then there's the part where, as we were discussing earlier as well, has Alzolay really lost it? Really? You're telling me after what he put together last year that this is it for him? So I think some of it's like, all right, let's go to it again, and now things are going to change. We got to take a break. I'm Mark Rohde on The Score. Couple more things before we get out of here on the Cubs, since we just haven't done Hayden Wesneski justice today after his sparkling performance. Cubs lost. That's why it's pushed to the background a little bit. But Wesneski goes 6 1/3, did not allow a run, 3 hits, 8 strikeouts, 2 walks, 90 pitches. And this was one of those days where if you were watching, you were seeing a pitcher who seemed to be getting better as he went along. It's not like he got all those strikeouts early in his performance. I was particularly impressed with his fifth inning, where he's really just bearing down and strikes out the last two guys of the fifth inning. Then he strikes out a couple of guys in the sixth inning, and then eventually Council pulls him with one out in the seventh inning. Again, I didn't have a problem with Council pulling him, even though he was still seemingly going strong. It's a young pitcher who's been banged up some this year. There's probably some sort of pitch, you know, again, 90 pitches. There's probably some sort of pitch count territory that they want to be in with him. And well, Council's been burned a few times by keeping guys in just a little bit too long. So I thought he handled it well with Wesneski. I was okay with Alzolay coming in. Like I said, just don't do it again. Now I have reached my limit with Alzolay. You just cannot do that. The other thing too that I want to talk about, like in terms of the offense has not been going well either. I realize that Alzolay has dominated the conversation here today, but the offense has not been particularly good recently either. One of the at bats in this game drove me crazy. It was Matt Mervis, fourth inning, no score in the game at the time, runners on second and third, two outs. So, you know, it's a potential clutch situation for Matt Mervis. He works a 2-1 count, looked good, looked comfortable up there. Then he took the next two pitches, which were both strikes, backwards K, strikes out looking. The problem was, is that like they were both no doubt about it strikes. They were right in the K zone. I just don't know what Matt Mervis was thinking on that particular play right there. I'd like to know. And I know that that probably didn't get asked. I doubt Matt Mervis was even spoken to after the game. But my baseball sensibilities were stimulating me to say, why? Why, Matt Mervis, did you take those two pitches? They didn't look like he was fooled too badly. But apparently, he was in that case, and that was just symbolic, I think, of the Cubs' offense today. Except, Christopher Morel, another bomb. I mean, God, a shot to say. By the way, wind blowing in today, and Morel just launched one to dead center field. Dansby Swanson hit one to the exact same part of the ballpark. I thought it was gone off the bat. And nothing, but Morel, man, that guy can lift a lot of weight. Let's just put it that way. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thank you for texting and calling. I always appreciate you guys listening. And just for that, I'm going to do another show tomorrow. I'm going to be on from 11 a.m. until 12:45. I am being told that Rick Sutcliffe will be on the show tomorrow. John Greenberg will join me between 11 and 12:45 as well. So I'm looking forward to that. Thank you to Trey Wingo, Andy Martinez, and Mike Golic Jr. for being on the show. Thanks a ton to Alex Kuhn, who put it all together for us. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you guys later. I'll talk to you tomorrow right here on The Score. A couple more things before we get out of here on the Cubs, since we just haven't done Hayden Wesneski justice today after his sparkling performance. Cubs lost. That's why it's pushed to the background a little bit. But Wesneski goes 6 1/3, did not allow a run, 3 hits, 8 strikeouts, 2 walks, 90 pitches. And this was one of those days where if you were watching, you were seeing a pitcher who seemed to be getting better as he went along. It's not like he got all those strikeouts early in his performance. I was particularly impressed with his fifth inning, where he's really just bearing down and strikes out the last two guys of the fifth inning. Then he strikes out a couple of guys in the sixth inning, and then eventually Council pulls him with one out in the seventh inning. Again, I didn't have a problem with Council pulling him, even though he was still seemingly going strong. It's a young pitcher who's been banged up some this year. There's probably some sort of pitch, you know, again, 90 pitches. There's probably some sort of pitch count territory that they want to be in with him. And well, Council's been burned a few times by keeping guys in just a little bit too long. So I thought he handled it well with Wesneski. I was okay with Halzelay coming in. Like I said, just don't do it again. Now I have reached my limit with Halzelay. You just cannot do that. The other thing, too, that I want to talk about, like in terms of the offense has not been going well either. I realize that Halzelay has dominated the conversation here today, but the offense has not been particularly good recently either. One of the at-bats in this game drove me crazy. It was Matt Mervis, fourth inning, no score in the game at the time, runners on second and third, two outs. So, you know, it's a potential clutch situation for Matt Mervis. He works a 2-1 count, looked good, looked comfortable up there. Then he took the next two pitches, which were both strikes, backwards K, strikes out looking. The problem was, is that like they were both no doubt about it strikes. They were right in the K zone. I just don't know what Matt Mervis was thinking on that particular play right there. I'd like to know. And I know that that probably didn't get asked. I doubt Matt Mervis was even spoken to after the game. But my baseball sensibilities were stimulating me to say, why? Why, Matt Mervis, did you take those two pitches? They didn't look like he was fooled too badly. But apparently, he was in that case, and that was just symbolic, I think, of the Cubs' offense today. Except, Christopher Morel, another bomb. I mean, God, a shot to set. By the way, wind blowing in today, and Morel just launched one to dead center field. Dansby Swanson hit one to the exact same part of the ballpark. I thought it was gone off the bat. And nothing, but Morel, man, that guy can lift a lot of weight. Let's just put it that way. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thank you for texting and calling. I always appreciate you guys listening. And just for that, I'm going to do another show tomorrow. I'm going to be on from 11 a.m. until 12:45. I am being told that Rick Sutcliffe will be on the show tomorrow. John Greenberg will join me between 11 and 12:45 as well. So I'm looking forward to that. Thank you to Trey Wingo, Andy Martinez, and Mike Golic Jr. for being on the show. Thanks a ton to Alex Kuhn, who put it all together for us. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you guys later. I'll talk to you tomorrow right here on The Score.